This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by
Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Enjoy the show.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's late December, and charities are making their year-end push for donations. In New Hampshire alone, there are many choices. About 8,000 nonprofits with a wide range of missions, from statewide conservation groups to regional mental health centers to local food pantries. And many Granite Staters also hear appeals from international nonprofits, tackling the world's toughest problems, from Ebola to saving the rainforest. So what's a donor to do when it comes to figuring out which worthy cause to support? Increasingly, some are asking tough questions, requesting hard evidence of success, and demanding more transparency. But this can be a major challenge for some organizations. How do you measure in immediate, concrete terms, for instance, progress on literacy or poverty? How do you argue for new computers and other office support when your broader goal is to house the homeless? And how do you get your message out to the general public without a mammoth marketing budget? We're looking at these questions and more this hour on The Exchange, and we want to know what you think. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Joining us by phone is Kat Rosqueta. She's founding executive director of the Center for High Impact Philanthropy at the University of Pennsylvania. She's also on the adjunct faculty at the School of Social Policy and Practice and at the Wharton School. Kat Rosqueta, it's really good to have you. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us in studio, Mary Ellen Jackson, executive director of the New Hampshire Center for Nonprofits. And Mary Ellen, welcome back.
Thank you, Laura.
And also with us, Dick Ober, President and Chief Executive Officer of the New Hampshire Charitable Foundation. And Dick, good to see you. Thanks for being here.
Good to be here.
Well, Dick, I want to turn to you first. We always see these national state-by-state rankings year by year of who is the most charitable state. And most years, New Hampshire comes out bumping along the bottom. This year, we're dead last. What do you think? Why do we always come out at the bottom of this list? We're looking kind of scroogey to the rest of the nation.
Well, we come out low in overall charitable giving measured by dollars given, but there's one fundamental reason for that. All of the New England states tend to be lower than the U.S. as a whole, and that's because most charitable giving goes to church and faith-based organizations. And New England is the most secular region in the country, and New Hampshire is particularly secular.
So does that mean we're off the hook? We're not as bad as we look? Because you see the national headlines, you know, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and they say, okay, least charitable state, New Hampshire.
Yeah. No, we're not off the hook. If you take all charitable giving, we rank last. But if you take out church giving, we're around 31 or 32. So that's still not good enough for a state like New Hampshire that's so dependent on the nonprofit sector. But there's one other way to look at this, too. If you look at the percentage of people who give anything, we're 12th. So there's an impulse to give in New Hampshire. I think people recognize the importance. A high percentage of people give something. We just don't give enough.
Now, what do you think, Kat Rosqueta? How do you interpret these 50 state rankings from your perspective?
I mean, Dick is absolutely right in terms of the connection between religiosity and giving, because religious organizations are a primary recipient. So I think his analysis is correct. I think some of the other things you can look at to get a sense of the generosity is the percentage of citizens in a state who give. So is it spread out? You've got a large population who are generous as opposed to an isolated few who are giving those dollars. And also to look at volunteering, which is another way that people contribute to their communities in addition to the philanthropic or charitable monies.
Talking about the religiosity for just a minute, Kat, you know, so people say in New Hampshire, all right, well, if you take out the churches, we don't look so bad. But some of these churches do very good work. You know, they run food pantries, they run after-school programs for kids, they run Alcoholics Anonymous programs. So it's not like all the money given to churches is going to, you know, velvet pews.
Absolutely. I mean, there are many motivations for giving to religious organizations. Some is you feel an obligation, the tradition of tithing. You're a member of this community and feel a responsibility to give to this community. But another is exactly what you're pointing out, which is religious communities, because of the values that folks hold, are in a position to provide a lot of support to needier individuals and families in their community. So it's not quite so black and white that giving to a religious organization does not mean supporting community efforts. In many cases, it's both an expression of your faith and of your belonging, as well as an opportunity to help those less fortunate in your community.
Well, Mary Ellen Jackson, I'd love your perspective on this, too. I'm sure you look at those rankings every year when they come out.
Oh, absolutely, Laura. But one thing we're forgetting, and in New Hampshire, the nonprofit sector, I think, partners deeper than any other state. So in New Hampshire, in those churches, are small nonprofits doing the work. And so it's sometimes you have to peel back the onion a little bit to see. Years ago, I ran a family resource center. We were located within a church. Many of the child care centers are located within a church. So there's this quiet partnership that's going on, and that may weigh into some of the differences.
What's your broader sense, Mary Ellen, of how generous or ungenerous Granite Staters are? I'm sure you talk to colleagues around the country.
Oh, absolutely. I don't think you can really discern how generous a population is. I think when you combine volunteerism, we are ranking out of the park. We're also a state that borders Massachusetts, and we border people have interests that cross over. So we're seeing a lot of giving to regional nonprofit organizations. So we're a complex little state, and that's not to say the nonprofit sector doesn't have some work ahead of it to be more clear about what's going on.
Well, and I definitely want to explore some new ideas, new notions about how nonprofits operate, how they get their message out, how they raise their money. There was an interesting article that I came across recently that said nonprofits need to operate more like businesses. Let's inject a little capitalism in the nonprofit sector. We'll dig into that in just a minute. The exchange number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. We're taking a look at charitable giving in New Hampshire, from what factors donors consider when they give to why Granite Staters seem to give so little, although we're peeling the onion a little there, as Mary Ellen says. 1-800-892-6477. If you work for a nonprofit, what's your perspective on this issue? If you're feeling overwhelmed by end-of-the-year appeals for donations, how do you decide who to give to, how much to give? Again, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter. A couple more numbers that I want to crunch with all of you and then get into some of these newer ideas. And Dick Ober, there were some new numbers from the Chronicle of Philanthropy showing about how giving habits have changed recently. So who gives more to charity as a percentage of their income? Is it, you know, the fabulously wealthy, the Warren Buffetts and the Bill Gateses? Is it the upper middle class? Is it the middle class? Is it, you know, lower income folks who don't have a lot, but they really want to help? Who tends to pitch in the most relative to their capacity?
Lower and moderate income families tend to give more as a portion of their overall income. But when you look at the total dollars given, the higher income families in all are going to give more.
Sure, because they have more, yeah.
Exactly, although a portion of their income. And it's such a fascinating question. What do we mean by giving? You know, there's some interesting polling that says if you buy a box of Girl Scout cookies, are you giving? If you're donating food to a food bank, are you giving? If you're a member in an environmental organization, is that a charitable gift? And I think the beauty of this is the idea of philanthropy, the idea of charitable giving, is a distinctly American value. It's embedded in our culture. It's embedded in our public policy. And we've come to accept this concept of private action for public good, voluntarily giving of our own of our treasure, of our talent, and our time to better our communities. It is a distinctly American thing. And in New England, one of the ironies we see is that because, especially in New Hampshire, we have a commitment to smaller government. So if there is one state where it really needs people to step up and to give and to engage in their community in all of those ways, it's ours.
So if we want small government, fine, but there are these social service agencies, these nonprofits who are carrying out the work that might be done by governments elsewhere, Dick? Is that what you're saying?
That's right.
It's really interesting to hear you say what you just said. And there's a lot in there, Kat. What do we mean by giving? You know, how do you define this? It's interesting what Dick says. There's a couple things there that I hadn't even thought about. For example, if you're a member of a local conservation group, is that a charitable gift? I'd love your thoughts there too, Kat.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there is a unique historical context for this tradition of giving here in the United States, which is it's a nation that was founded out of a revolution, right? We threw off a sovereign, and there wasn't a sort of noble class that everybody looked to take care of our needs. And so because of that, historically and culturally, we've always been a nation that has used private effort in all sorts of ways to ensure that the needs of our communities are met. And that includes things like volunteerism, which we've all spoken about. Much of that is not formally captured. So that includes things like helping your neighbor, taking care of their kids, bringing over meals when somebody's sick. It includes the more structured nonprofit sector, right? We have 501c3 tax status, and we get a tax deduction when we as donors give to these voluntary nonprofit organizations. And then sort of fast forward to today, where you have things like crowdfunding, where people are supporting projects that may or may not be charitable, but is a way to support people whose work you believe in. I mean, that whole tapestry is part of what giving looks like here in the U.S.
How much harder is it for people like you, Kat, to measure this then, given all the different ways that people can give?
Yeah. Well, so our center here at Penn is not so much focused on how much giving is happening. There's some great research centers around the country who look at that. What our center is focused on is when individuals and foundations are making philanthropic gifts, financial philanthropic gifts, how can they make sure those gifts make the biggest possible difference they can?
And I think that's what every donor wants when they give. And coming up, we'll start hearing from our listeners how they make that decision. Of course, I want to hear from the three of you about how people should sort through all the appeals, plus the numbers that are out there these days, the idea that you want to give to an organization that has a low overhead. There's some discussion about that. We'll pick up on that after a short break, and we'll start hearing from you. Email us at exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the state of charitable giving in the Granite State and some new thinking around our notions of nonprofits. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And Kat Rosketta, Dick Ober, Mary Ellen Jackson, let's go to our listeners now. And Anne is calling from Saxton's River, Vermont. Hi, Annie, go ahead. You're on The Exchange.
Hi, thanks for having me. I am a director of development and marketing for a nonprofit called Girls on the Run Vermont. And I have found that in the last, 5 or 10 years, the whole world of nonprofits has become competitive, for lack of a better word. There are just a lot of wonderful new nonprofits that are opening up each year. So competing for those dollars is more of a challenge. But I found that the more personal you can be in soliciting donations, the more the whole experience resonates for a donor, whether it's an individual or a business. So in our fundraising materials, we really try to tell the story of what we do and how we help empower girls to be physically and emotionally healthy. And it's it's just got a lot of impact, you know, the
so
more
So you're in Vermont. Yeah, you're in Vermont, Annie, which is also a low-giving state. You kind of share that spot with New Hampshire year after year. So how do you sort of get around that, and how challenging is it to, you know, hire great people or, you know, work in an office that isn't in a smelly basement? You know what I'm saying?
Yep. Well, the organization is celebrating its 15th year, actually, this year. So it's grown from the kitchen of our executive director, Nancy Heidinger, to a really big space in a, you know, a warehouse building. But it's a beautiful space. And in terms of finding staff, there are a lot of great people in this state. So it actually has been a case of, you know, choosing the best person out of many wonderful people. There are so many talented people. So on that count, you know, we're actually really lucky. But we do struggle with, you know, a tight budget, and we all pitch in whenever, you know, there's one thing happening for one department that requires extra hands. We roll up our sleeves and we all pitch in.
Okay.
So it's that kind of an organization. But in terms of, you know, finding donors, my goal is to always find people for whom our program resonates in a personal way.
Sure, someone who was a runner. You're probably not going to go to someone who was a rower in college. Go to people who were on the track team and so forth. Thank you for calling in. You know, a couple things that come out of that call, and again, thanks, Annie. Mary Ellen Jackson, just the idea that so many little nonprofits in New England, New Hampshire, your expertise, some people have said, we have too many nonprofits doing the same thing.
Well, we hear that all the time. There's, if you look at the nonprofit sector, let's just take New Hampshire. So 80% of the nonprofits of that 8,000 number are under 100,000. Those are small, local. They're sort of, I call it the fabric of the community. They're your local food pantry. They may be your PTO, et cetera, the cemetery trustees, et cetera. If you choose to give locally, you can just be in your community and know what's going on and give to the art festival that's happening every summer, et cetera. Above that is about 1,200 organizations to 1,500 organizations that have operations, that have staffing, that are sort of moving the needle, excuse me, on social issues. If you want to give in that stratosphere, so to speak, I do think you can find out and you can ask good questions. There's a billboard that just went up in Boston, and it's Dan Pallotta's Charity Defense Fund. But anyway, the billboard says, don't ask about low overhead. Ask about high impact. So part of this is awareness. It's and interestingly enough, in that number of the 1,200 with budgets over 100,000, there hasn't been very much growth at all. So the growth is at people with new ideas or forming nonprofits. It's the educated donor that's going to be able to step back and say, on what sort of stratosphere do I want to have impact? I'll tell you one more quick story. Warren Buffett recently gave significantly to a food pantry in Seattle. Someone said to him, well, how did you know they were having results? He said, I walked in. So part of this is, if you want to have long-range impact, you may want to look around New Hampshire and look at organizations that are changing things systematically, be it Families in Transition, be it Families First in the Seacoast, be it Arts Alive in Keene. They're sort of changing the system in which we work. If you want to have your community, your neighborhood impact, walk into the local food pantry and give. So I think it boils down to that.
Okay, so you mentioned Dan Pallotta. Mm-hmm. So I think I know what you're talking about, but just give us a little there. And I know Dick and Kat will have something to say about this,
too. Yeah, I won't go off track on that too much. Dan Pallotta's run around the country for a long time talking about this overhead myth. And he's a writer, and he's creating this charity defense fund. And it's aimed at changing our impression of nonprofit work and understanding. It threads back to your comment. Nonprofits should act like businesses. Well, we absolutely do. The difference is that we have, over the years, sort of adopted this sense that a quality nonprofit doesn't pay anything to overhead. Everything goes right out the door. And any business knows that that's impossible to have impact. We want to have resources to do the job well.
Well, you have to have a computer.
Absolutely.
And you have to turn the lights on.
Absolutely.
And if you want to have
impact, you have to invest in research and development. And I see the funding community moving that way very swiftly.
All right. Well, let's tackle this. Dick Ober and Kat. Dick, you first. The overhead myth.
It really is about impact. It is about organizations that understand what their mission is and focus on that mission. The idea that you shouldn't invest in a strong staff, you shouldn't invest in information technology, you shouldn't invest in marketing, it's kind of silly. You said before nonprofits should be more like businesses. Nonprofits actually are businesses. They are often small, medium, large businesses that happen to file their taxes differently than for-profit businesses. They're facing all of the same issues. As our caller said, they're facing increased competition. They're facing the competition to hire good talent, to meet payroll, and all of those things. I think that when we look ahead and think about the truly transformational work being done at that intersect between passionate donors with their resources and effective nonprofits, I mean, this is such an inspiring field. You can always talk about the scarcity. You can talk about where there are problems. But if you think about the remarkable impact that nonprofits are having every single day in New Hampshire, there is not a family in New Hampshire whose lives aren't touched by a nonprofit every day. And generous, thoughtful, passionate donors are making that happen. We virtually never have donors say, well, I'm not really interested in nonprofits that spend more than 19.5% of their administrative overhead. People give to organizations that they believe in. People give to people. I loved Annie's, our caller's, comment before. We believe in no numbers without stories, no stories without numbers. Charitable giving is this beautiful blend of the head and heart. Some people go more with the heart. Some people go more with the head. But in the end, this is just an extraordinary, inspiring thing that happens every single day in our communities.
Well, and Kat, I definitely want to get to you. But Dick, just to push back a little bit, when people do hear stories about, you know, this CEO of this major nonprofit makes a gazillion dollars, they do feel like, I don't know if I want to give to that or not. I mean, make a reasonable salary, but I want my money to go to people who really need it.
Yeah. And as always, one or two stories like that end up having lots and lots of impact. What Dan Plott and others say is if we reward performance in the for-profit sector, why wouldn't we reward performance in the nonprofit sector? There are certainly isolated instances where a nonprofit board might lose sight of how they're investing their dollars. These are tiny, isolated instances compared to the extraordinary work being done day in and day out by nonprofit professionals being compensated fairly for the extraordinary work they do in the community.
Okay, Kat, I'm sure you've thought about this. The overhead myth that some people say, this sort of balance between not wanting to be too she or too fancy because people want to feel like their money is going to really help the cause.
Yeah. Well, you can imagine as someone who leads the Center for High Impact Philanthropy, for us, everything is focused on the impact. So the problem with too much of a focus on overhead ratios is that if you stop and think about what an overhead ratio is, it's an accounting issue. It's what funds are going into one set of things that you buy compared to the funds that are going into other sets of things that you buy, computer system versus food, say, if you're a food pantry. That's all just focused on the inputs. You're still only focused on what are you using to make the change you seek. High impact philanthropy is all about, given everything you spend, what are the results? What's the change in the world you're creating? And if you can create a bigger change by upgrading your systems or hiring the kind of people who know how to manage volunteers and get more resources and serve your clients better, then it seems like those investments are ones you ought to be making. And that's unfortunately what has happened with the overemphasis on overhead ratios, is it's led to these perverse activities where people aren't investing in the very types of things that could actually help them achieve their missions faster and sooner.
Can you give us a little example, either real or sort of a for instance, Kat, on what mm-hmm. you're talking about there?
Mm-hmm. So here could be one example where you have a soup kitchen, and they're it's all volunteer run, and they've been able to do a good job of getting donated items and providing food to those who are hungry in the local community. But because of unemployment and the economic conditions, there are more and more people who need food. But you can only get so much out of the volunteer help because those volunteers also have jobs and other responsibilities. Now, hiring somebody, a staff person, who's responsible for managing those volunteers and maybe going out and seeing if there are more donations from local supermarkets, that could increase your capacity to serve more hungry people. But because that and maybe the computer you need to give them in order to organize this might count as overhead, you don't wind up making that investment for fear that your overhead ratio is going to skyrocket. Right? That's an example of not investing in something that would actually help you help more people.
So to use a worn-out phrase, penny wise and pound foolish.
Exactly. And thank you for alluding to our founder here, Benjamin Franklin.
Joining us from Pennsylvania, Kat. So what's a reasonable ratio? I mean, again, I hear what you're saying. On the other hand, I don't want to help fund, you know, a waterfall in the lobby, so to speak. I mean, I know that's a ridiculous mm-hmm. example, but what is a reasonable ratio? Is 50-50 okay? Is 90-10 okay? I mean, what's reasonable?
Yeah. So two points on that. One is I think that's the wrong ratio to look at. I think the ratio you should be looking at, donors should be looking at, is what's the cost per impact? What's the bang for buck? How much money does it take to achieve the good thing that you want to create? How much money to feed a family of four for a week? How much money to ensure that a child who statistically is so far behind isn't reading on grade level by grade three is reading on grade level? So something like $40 to feed a family of four for a week with a well-run food pantry, or $500 to ensure this at-risk child is reading on grade level. Those are the kinds of ratios we should be thinking, not percent of overhead. Now, if you ever see an overhead ratio that seems far out of whack with everything else that you've seen, you know, that is a little bit of a red flag. So I wouldn't dismiss them entirely, but I think if you care about impact, if you care about results, then overhead ratios are not the indicators that are going to help you understand that.
Let's go back to our listeners. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. If you're getting lots of end-of-the-year appeals from New Hampshire's nonprofits, how are you sorting through those requests for money? How do you decide who to give to and how? Also, if you work for a nonprofit, how do you feel about donor expectations these days and this overhead myth that we've been digging into? Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter. In Bedford, Judith is on the line. Hi, Judith. Go ahead. You're on the Exchange.
Good morning.
Morning.
I recently read a book, and I believe it's entitled The Path Ahead or The Path by Nicholas Kristof. He writes for the New York Times, and he also wrote the book Half the Sky, which may help someone find it. It is all about philanthropy and the things you're talking about, the ratio of overhead and which are successful programs to sponsor and which aren't. I recommend that book to people.
What's the takeaway for you, Judith? What's sort of the big lesson that you got? Yeah.
The big lesson I got is there are a lot of people out there trying to do a lot of very good things. Some work out and some don't. His book was phenomenal.
How has that made you perhaps change your behavior as a donor to say yes to this appeal and no to that one?
The person who spoke before talking about the personal contact, I have shifted more of my donations to where I can actually see the day-to-day operation and the impact and the results. And I'm standing on the front porch of the Holy Cross Family Learning Center because I'm a volunteer teacher here where I teach English to recent refugees to our country. And I can see the impact. So when I make a donation, I can see what happens, whether both with my time and with my money.
Okay. Judith, thanks a lot for calling in. I appreciate
it. You're welcome.
What do you think? I'll throw this to you first, Mary Lynn Jackson. A lot of people trying to do a lot of good things, but sometimes it doesn't work out.
Well, you know, we haven't had an appetite for failure in the nonprofit sector. And that's, again, something you learn from your failures.
And businesses do fail all the time.
And that's how you learn and that's how you get better. And along the way, the interesting thing in a nonprofit, though, is you could say a program you funded didn't get that child up to third grade reading. But along the way, the child might have had a better home environment. The child might have had more security. There might have been other resources. And along the way, the nonprofit learned that the strategies they were using wouldn't prepare them for literacy. So we do have to open up our thinking because we do want to make impact on these very critical issues. People care about humanity and who is taking care of the community and people if we don't learn what works and what doesn't. But like I said, the good news is it's mostly hardworking board and staff and volunteers that are trying everything they can to move the needle. But again, we do have to be able to learn from our mistakes, and funders have to partner with us. We're partners. We're mission partners.
Well, here's the thing. And again, businesses fail all the time, and, you know, that's just the way it goes. But when a business fails, it's that person's own investment. When a nonprofit fails, that might be my investment. So I'm not feeling so good about that.
I think in terms of nonprofits tend to, like I said, they're doing good along the way. And then if they fail, if you call failure closing your doors, perhaps, the way the state works and the way the law works is that the resources are transitioned over to another nonprofit and carried on with the mission. So it's not that it stops dead cold. Again, I think the original and the woman that was just on the phone, Judith, she put it beautifully and very simply, is you need to know the nonprofit needs to communicate clearly and constantly with those who are giving. And those who are giving, it's all about communication and knowing what's going on. I'll end right there.
Okay. Well, and after a break, I want to ask you, Kat, and maybe you too, Dick Gober, this idea of Judith feeling better about giving locally. Dick, I'm sure you think that's wonderful, but I am wondering about, you know, the future of big organizations like Doctors Without Borders and people that are fighting, you know, refugee crises and so forth abroad. We'll take more of your calls, too. Thanks, Judith, for that one. The number 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, new notions about charitable giving and how nonprofits should operate. Let's hear from you at this time of year when many organizations are making their end-of-the-year appeals. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests in studio, Mary Ellen Jackson, Executive Director of the New Hampshire Center for Nonprofits, Dick Ober, President and Chief Executive Officer of the New Hampshire Charitable Foundation, and Kat Rose Ketta, Founding Executive Director of the Center for High Impact Philanthropy at the University of Pennsylvania. And real quick to you, Kat, to Judith's point from Bedford, and thanks again, Judith, for calling. She said, look, I just feel a lot better giving locally. That's great. I'm sure our guests in the studio think that's great. But what about those international organizations, Kat, that are working on important issues like Ebola, like refugees?
Well, there are great organizations to support, both locally and around the world. Although we have a kind of unique history with our nonprofit sector, there are NGOs working everywhere who are trying to make a better world. What we found is that, you know, every donor, there's a saying we have on our team, you've spoken to one donor. And everybody has their own portfolio, and for some people, that portfolio is 100% focused on organizations around them whose impact they can see very directly. And for other people, because of a newspaper article that they read after a disaster, or because maybe they have family who have who live in their region, or it's a cause that resonates with them. They're a mother, and they feel an empathy with all parents around the world and want to make sure that every child, no matter where they are, has the same opportunity. You know, for those reasons, they are looking at a portfolio that might be a little more diverse, where they might give both to an organization like Nurse Family Partnership, helping moms locally in their community, and they may also give to an organization like a Doctors Without Borders, who is desperately trying to make sure that mothers and their children are still staying safe after a major crisis or disaster. It doesn't have to be an either-or, but it's usually an individual's philanthropic path that helps them determine what does their portfolio look like.
Let's take another call. This is Claire in Londonderry, Vermont. Hi, Claire. You're on The Exchange.
Yes, good morning. My comment is twofold. I think from the Secretary of State, you can get a list of charities and what percentage of that those charities actually receive the dollars you're sending and the percentage, and use that as a guideline. The other thing is helps me is I have a charity of choice. This way you don't have to worry about others. The National Alliance on Mental Illness has changed my life. And so that is my charity of choice, and that is a secure place to be when you're talking to the 100 people who would like you to donate to their worthy cause.
Well, so you said, Claire, that you look at the overhead, though, and
a determination, yes.
So yes. It is important to you how much money does go to that administrative
because otherwise
overhead.
You're throwing it away.
Okay, so we talked about this earlier. Claire, thank you so much. What do you think, Dick Gober? People are still feeling... You know, we hear you on the idea that you don't want to spend, you know, $1 million on sparkling fountains in your lobby, but people don't want to throw their money away, as Claire says.
Well, look, it's one of many, many things you should look at. I love Claire's call because she's being planful about her charitable giving. I think it makes sense for people to think about their charitable giving the same way they think about other things in their life. Donors think they're almost just have to sit back and wait for lots of fundraising appeals to come to them, and then they've got to sort it out. What do you care about? What are you passionate about? You have to start there. And if you think that through, what do you want to try to accomplish with your charitable dollars? Just like what do you want to accomplish with your food budget? What do you want to accomplish with your retirement? All these things. I think if people thought about their charitable giving as intentionally as they think about other aspects of their life, a lot of this would go away.
That's interesting. So, you know, if you're not Bill Gates and you really can't, you know, give a ton, just think about one thing like Claire, Dick, and just go, this is where I'm going to make a difference.
What gives you goosebumps? What makes you smile, laugh, or cry? Start there. And then there are lots of tools to determine the kind of questions are asking. Who's doing good work in that space? Mary Ellen had a great comment, as did several other callers. Walk in, experience these places if they're local. But part of being intentional is, do you want to give locally or do you want to give to great need halfway across the world? Do you want to give today, right now, immediately to help the hungry children, or do you want to invest in long-term systems change so there's fewer hungry children in the future? All those are good. Give today, give tomorrow, give perpetually, give right now. I think really being clear about your passion, what you want to accomplish with your charitable dollars, and then go for it. Claire has made her decision. NAMI is a wonderful organization, probably changed her life, and now she's going to help them change others.
Claire, thanks for the call. So, Kat, long-term versus short-term. I have read that Americans are quite generous after a crisis. So there's an earthquake in Haiti or, you know, a terrible mudslide somewhere. We'll give. But then long-term, we're a little skeptical. We think, I'm not really sure how much of a difference, you know, that long-term investment is making. I'd love your thoughts there on sort of the short-term versus long-term nature of our giving.
Yeah, and just to clarify, because it's a little different when we're talking about disaster response than we are about other issues, and part of that is the chaos after a disaster often means that the focus is on very immediate need, and one of the things that centers like ours and those involved in the disaster response are trying to encourage people to remember that even after that immediate need is met, there are very long-term needs that persist where people will still need your help. So I think disaster response is one where the need continues long after the headlines fade. But going back to Dick's point, even outside of disaster response, you know, the for good or bad, there are a lot of needs out there that donors can really make a difference in. And there are a lot of organizations working in the short, medium, and long term on almost every issue you can think of, whether it's education or environmental issues or health issues. And for some people, the immediacy of the short-term need is what moves them. And so they fund there. For other folks, often because they have been giving in a while in the same space, so they've seen, they've gotten them frustrated at the lack of systemic change that they want to see, they may then begin to invest in more midterm and long-term options, the kind of broad change that means those immediate needs no longer exist. That when I spoke earlier about the portfolio that many donors have, even if they may not think of it as a portfolio, those are some of the considerations that that define where they're putting their money.
Let's go to Reeve in Wolfboro. Hi, Reeve. You're on the Exchange. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. I wanted to say that when I decide where to donate, and I have to say I am an itty-bitty philanthropist. I don't have a lot to do. But I made a decision a few years ago to go both with local, but with it even more important to me, to prevent problems. So two local organizations, one in Wolfboro, the Appalachian Mountain Teen Project, and one in OSAPI, Global Awareness, Local Action, or GALA, they both work on issues that are really big problems, but they work on them, and it's really hard to get funding for them. Like the AMTP will identify kids who may be at risk because of something that's happened in their family, and we'll track and follow and work with them in schools in advance. And the data on that is so impressive about how these kids both, they also work through the summer. They are in so much less trouble after getting involved with this group. And Global Awareness Local Action works with building sustainability and community education for sustainable issues. And I just think both are, they're hard to get funding for because it's easy to get funding for someone, you know, once a child is pregnant or once a building is burned down. But it's so much harder to say, hey, we're solving problems in advance. So GALA and the AMTP are two really good examples of that kind of work, I think.
Okay. Well, Reeve, thanks for calling in. I love the way she describes herself as a teeny-weeny philanthropist. That's great. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Email us, exchange@nhpr.org. A couple emails have come in. Here's Ed. He says, New Hampshire's low rank, a function that no one has any money left in their coffers due to the gazillion NHPR fund drives throughout the year that rely on overwhelming guilt penetration to achieve their objective. How can you possibly host a program exploring charitable giving in the Granite State? Does New Hampshire philanthropic ranking include the NHPR donation? Ed, thanks for that comment. And I'm guessing that our numbers include all giving to all nonprofits, and that includes us. Thanks for chiming in there, Ed. Here's another one from Ray. He says, one of the issues in regard to giving is to who? I have made a list of the groups, organizations that I receive in the mail, and I'm up to 95. Wow, Ray. He says, how do I analyze which groups are effective, which groups spend the least on overhead? Now, Mary Ellen Jackson, we keep coming back to this issue of overhead, but just in general, how would you quickly answer, Ray, how do I analyze these 95 groups?
Well, the one thing I would do want to say is because it keeps coming back, these overhead questions, the nonprofit sector has got to find something else to insert in there. So that's our challenge. I think, Ray, you do have to step back. There's a whole lot of ways you can get direction. You know, the Charitable Foundation is organized around funds that donors advise. The local United Ways pretty much know what's going on in a community. An organization like ours, the New Hampshire Center for Nonprofits, there's a lot of ways that you can educate yourself. And it really does go back to what everyone is saying today. Know what you care about. Look around locally. You can put your mail aside. Think about what you care about. What is
put the mail aside.
Well,
how
let me get back
feel and, about that?
And then go back to it. Think about what you want, what is important to you. The other side of the coin is that the nonprofit organization. One of your colleagues made that point. We have to get. It's the intersection. It's the intersection between to people who care deeply about a mission. So once you put the mail aside, you go back to it and you fill out and you give to those organizations that you feel match what you want to accomplish on your time on this world. What do you want to give to?
Well, Ray, thanks for the email. And, you know, there are lots of new and creative ways in which people are giving. We all remember the Ice Bucket Challenge, for example, over the summer, people using Facebook and Twitter and really innovative ways to bring in more dollars to people who might not have been donors otherwise. But, Kat, I want to ask you about an old-fashioned way of giving, especially this time of year. November and December, every time we turn around, somebody's organizing a food drive. People celebrate this. They say, hey, we gathered X million pounds of food. Should people be doing these food drives? How effective are they?
Well, it depends on how they're run and what your goal is. So a traditional food drive would go something like this. There'd be a list of non-perishable food items, and everybody would be encouraged to bring the same items, and you fill it in a big container on some high-profile area like the foyer of a big office building or at a school. And it does two things. One, it is a very visible way to remind people of the need in their own communities, and it does help, right? That, you know, a large percentage of that food can then go to people who are hungry, families and individuals who are hungry. But just like every other sector, the nonprofit sector overall has evolved, and we keep learning new and better ways to do things. And specifically, food drives and emergency food providers have evolved so that we actually have a national network of donated food coming everywhere from farmers, processors, packagers, distributors, retailers like restaurants and supermarkets. And there are now systems in place in, I think, every state in the country that can take that donated food and redistribute it to food banks and food pantries. Now, why is this such an innovation? Well, because that food is donated, that means that for a pound of food, you can now make sure a hungry family gets it, and it costs about 10 to 20 cents to get that, say, a box of pasta to a family who could use it for dinner. If we only relied on these canned food drives, think about how you get the food there. You go to the supermarket and you spend $2 to get that pound of pasta. So on a community or a state level, we can get so much more food to so many more families if instead of relying only on these canned food drives, we make financial contributions to the food banks, who can then use that money to pull more of this donated food from the national surplus that exists.
Yeah, we often hear that from food pantries. You know, the can of soup is great, but boy, if you give us $5, we can buy, you know, because we are savvy about discounts and so forth, we can buy many more cans of soup.
Yeah, yeah, yep.
You know, Dick Gober, I want to just close out with you. Mary Ellen mentioned this, and we keep getting back to this issue of overhead and how you decide what's effective and so forth. What about the marketing that nonprofits make about themselves, the messages that they put out there? Mary Ellen suggested this a little bit. Maybe we, the nonprofit sector, need to stop talking so much about overhead. Maybe nonprofits themselves have made this sort of a hyper-focus of donors.
I think the biggest thing is for a nonprofit to tell stories about what they're doing in the community. I had a very thoughtful couple met with recently who give part of their giving through the New Hampshire Charitable Foundation, as hundreds and hundreds of donors do in New Hampshire. And they said, here's the problem. I get a letter that there's 50 kids in my community that need my help. I make a generous donation. 6 months later, I get a letter that now there's 75 kids who need my help. And they're asking, is it my money's not doing anything, or are the nonprofits pressed to, with the competitive market, just to make a stronger and stronger case to my anxiety about what's going on in my community? What this couple said is, I want to know we helped one family. I need to know that there's a lot of need out there. Tell me a story of how my gift really helped one family and put that into perspective, or five families or 10 families. So the more nonprofits talk about the real work they're doing and the impact of that work. I think questions of the percentage of the dollars going to what somewhat recede. And I think Kat made an absolutely great point. You have to put it into perspective of what you're trying to accomplish and are you getting it done in the community.
So that's interesting. On the one hand, a nonprofit needs to say, look, there's a real problem. We're trying to address it. On the other hand, if every year the problem seems to get worse, donors think, well, why am I bothering? It's not helping.
Just so.
All right. Well, all of you, thank you for being here. Happy New Year. Happy holidays. Thanks a lot for your time. It was good to see you, Mary Ellen Jackson. Thanks
good
for
to
being
see
here.
You.
Mary Ellen Jackson, Executive Director of the New Hampshire Center for Nonprofits. Kat Rosketta, thank you also for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Kat Rosketta, Founding Executive Director of the Center for High Impact Philanthropy at the University of Pennsylvania. And Dick Ober, thank you as well.
Thank you, Laura.
Dick Ober, President and Chief Executive Officer of the New Hampshire Charitable Foundation. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. The senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producer is Faith Meixel. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our interns are Joanna Albertson-Grove and Nate Graby. Nate, we say goodbye to you today. Good luck back at Dartmouth. We hope to see you again soon. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoy.